Oye, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Mary J. Scholin presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. My name is Judge Scholin. To my right is Judge Allen. To my left is Judge Meredith. We're here today to hear the case of Marlesa D. Lynch and Cynthia M. Martinez versus Robert L. Wilkie, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 16-0541. Would counsel for each party please note your appearance for the record?
Sure. I'm Daniel Krasnodar, and with the accounting table are Aaron Ralston and Chris Walker for the appellants.
Thank you. Does appellant's counsel wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I wish to reserve 5 minutes.
Thank you. You may begin when you're ready. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's not on my cheat sheet.
Angela Costigan for the Secretary, and with me at counsel table is Ed Cassidy.
Thank you so much. Actually, it was. It wasn't my clerk's fault. It was my fault.
Judge Scholin, and may it please the court, my name is Daniel Krasnodar, and I represent the appellants Cynthia Martinez and Marlesa Lynch. What this case is about is whether the Board of Veterans Appeals erred when it said, although it had felt sympathy for the appellants, that it was not able to consider any evidence, that the duty to assist didn't matter, and that in fact it was required to deny the claim as a matter of law. We maintain that, in fact, that's not correct, and that the board was, in fact, able to and should have considered the evidence of record, specifically whether or not an application filed in 1969 by the grandparents of the appellants counted as a application either informal or incomplete or defective for the children. Because if it did, well, in fact, the children would be eligible for benefits. In addition, we believe that the board erred and the VA erred by not meeting its duty to assist, and that had it done so, it would have had the opportunity to find additional evidence which may well have informed about whether the application was an informal application or whether there were other applications or materials out there that might have allowed for benefits.
So what would be the place that you would point us to where this issue was raised before the board, you know, or what in your client's materials would have reasonably raised it for the board?
You're asking about which part specifically?
The part that the 1969 application was the critical thing.
I think the main thing that I would point to is that the appellants below did in fact raise, I think during a hearing, that the 1969 application was incomplete or was actually incorrectly completed. So I think that's enough with a sympathetic reading that the VA is required to have raised the issue.
So that's where if hypothetically one of us were concerned about something being reasonably raised for the board to have addressed it, that's where you want me to go. You want me to look at the hearing transcript.
I mean, that's the start of it. I mean, I would say that, you know, this is also something that it's not even so far as the that it wasn't or whether it was raised specifically by the appellants, but in fact that the board in their decision said that they're not allowed to consider anything else. So I think that it goes beyond that, and I think the board could have simply looked at the evidence with a sympathetic reading and addressed these questions.
Could I jump in there on the issue of whether these issues are reasonably raised about the 1969 application? Is it relevant that at that hearing the appellant's representative said that benefits were not sought on the children's behalf at the time of the veteran's death?
I mean, I think it's certainly something if the board was going to be considering whether or not the original application counts for the children that they could take into consideration. But I think ultimately they're not going to be, they're not waiving their right to have this application considered. The appellants were not represented by counsel, and I think that, again, the question I see here is whether the board has the opportunity to fix a problem. The board says that they're sympathetic to the plight of these children whose father was murdered while on active duty, but that there's nothing they can do. And my point is to say that, yeah, I think there is something they can do, and this is something they can look at, and if they really want to look at this sympathetically, they have the opportunity to do so, and they have the opportunity to fix it.
Let's say we agreed with you that the board could have discussed this. What in the application would have created any sort of notice to the secretary that, first of all, the children existed, and secondly, that they were the children of the veteran, that would have made VA have such an inquiry?
I think if you look at the four corners of the application from 1969 in a vacuum, the answer is nothing on that application says that the children exist. What I'm saying generally is that the board is not, we're not going back to 1969 and challenging a decision based on Q and saying that there's an error that was committed in 1969. We're asking whether the board in 2015 or post-2010, the VA, when they had additional information, whether they could look at that in context and then determine that, in fact, the original application had that information. But I don't think the original application on its face triggered anything obvious for the board to see, that there were children.
I'm struggling a little bit with the idea that something now could abate the finality of something then to somehow make it still be pending such that additional evidence would even come into play.
Well, I think the question is whether there is something final back then. Because if the question is was there a final decision as to whether the children were entitled to DIC benefits, the answer is no, there wasn't back in 1969, 1970. There is no decision saying that the children are granted or denied benefits at that point. And I think the answer is also that it's really not harmful to the VA in any way to say that the children can get benefits now with the benefit of hindsight about what actually happened. Because, you know, I don't think anyone is saying that children aren't entitled to benefits or wouldn't have been entitled had they made a clear application at the time. I think the question is now, can the VA do something to fix what was obviously a tragic situation?
Well, not to be harsh, but VA makes difficult or harsh decisions all the time or things that turn out poorly for veterans that in retrospect can't be corrected. And what makes your situation unique as opposed to a veteran who can't establish Q or some other circumstance like that, you know, that's what I'm trying to work with.
Well, I think there are a few things that do make the situation different. The first one is that we're talking about a situation where we have minor children who, at the time of the original application being filed, were not only not competent legally, but were, I think, both under 2 years old at the time. So actually physically couldn't actually do something, didn't have the ability to write, didn't have the ability to think through this or even know about the benefits. And so I think that that makes a difference between many other situations. This isn't a situation where the children knew about the benefits and sat on their rights. This is a situation where you know, there's an application, and VA actually uses a single application now for all DIC benefits so that they can be applied for all at once, where you have a series of benefits which are available upon the death of a veteran, I think that it's, I think that in the circumstance where you have a single application that's available for, and where you have a situation where the VA regulations allow for someone else to apply on behalf of a minor person, makes the situation different than when you have a veteran who would be stuck with Q, who is actually the same actor all along.
Shifting argument slightly, the Secretary raises the issue of paternity not being established, and I believe you asserted that the Board implicitly found that paternity was not an issue and that we are bound by that favorable finding. My reading of the Board decision is that that issue didn't come up at all because the Board basically, as a matter of law, found that they would not be eligible, and so it didn't get into that. Can you show me where you think I should draw an inference that the Board made this finding?
Well, I think that the Board had the opportunity, had they wished, to come in and say that the Board has the ability to overturn even favorable findings of the regional office, and they didn't do so. So I think, you know, that makes a difference when the Board is silent as to a fact that comes up. At a minimum, I would think that if the Board were to have any questions, that would be a matter for the Board to address in the first instance. So that's certainly something that could go back on remand if the Board had any questions about paternity, and that could be addressed as well.
Isn't this something that is perhaps better dealt with by the Secretary's ability to exercise equitable relief? I mean, this does strike me as a situation that could be, you know, the evil grandparents, and I don't know if that's true, but, you know, filing the application for themselves, saying that the children don't exist when they did exist. But it's really hard to sort of fit that round peg into the square hole.
I understand. And, you know, certainly Section 503, equitable relief is an option for the children. I think there are some potential barriers to that, and there are some bits of Section 503 that make it maybe not the perfect fit for this. Section 503 requires that the benefits not be awarded due to error on the part of the federal government. So, you know, one of the issues that we did talk about in our briefing is the duty to assist not being met. Well, you know, we might be able to find more information had the duty to assist been met that might have shown that, you know, the VA had actual notice of the children, and we might be able to make an argument at that point saying that Section 503 benefits or Section 503 equitable relief is appropriate. But right now, that's a higher bar that isn't present when the Board is actually looking at the question themselves. So I think that's an option for the children. I don't think it's necessarily the only option. I think that I really do strongly believe that the VA, you know, in its role as the sympathetic arbiter, and in its role as reading pleadings by pro se appellants sympathetically, there's the Shemars case, which says that the Board can develop evidence in order to determine whether something counts as an informal claim.
And so, this reading sympathetically, are you focusing on the 2010 application or the claim that your clients filed in 2010? I think that's the date, right?
Yes.
Or are you saying that the sympathetic reading should have been back in 1969?
I'm saying that today, which is when the VA is looking at the case, I think they can take in the whole of the evidence and they can look at both the 1969 application, not by itself, but also, you know, in the context of everything else that's happened, and they can give that 1969 document a sympathetic reading in light of the information that's come out in 2010. I don't know what would stop them from doing that.
Let's say that in 1969, we went back and looked at every document, everything that VA had, and we could actually get a hold of everything, and it all existed. There was no evidence that VA knew of the children's existence.
I think if there was no evidence in 1969 that they knew of the children's evidence, I don't know that there would be error in 1969 in not making a decision. So I don't.
So what does that do?
Because I think right now we aren't in 1969, and that makes all the difference, because when the board or the VA is looking at the case now, they're not looking at it in isolation, and that's why it's different than a Q claim. We're not sort of evaluating whether or not the 1969 decision was clearly and unmistakably erroneous based upon the information in the file at the time. We're saying, hey, is the board and the VA, are they allowed now, when they have information that comes in 2010, to look back at that 1969 application and say, hey, we actually think that looking at what we know now, that this is an informal claim?
Well, but that's my point. If there is no evidence in 1969 that the children could have filed a claim for themselves, that anybody filed a claim on their behalf, that VA knew about them, how does knowing that now, that they exist, create pendency in a document filed then? It's the connection that I'm struggling with.
I understand. And, you know, I almost promised that I wouldn't bring up the quantum physics analogy, but I think there is kind of
one. It may not be helpful for you.
But the point is that when you observe something in quantum physics under certain circumstances, it can actually change what you're seeing. And so the idea here is that, yeah, I think when you get the information in 2010, that it can actually change the nature of the 1969 application. It doesn't, it's pending, or it remains sort of dormant until you get that information. And then once the VA has that information, what's to stop the VA? What's the harm in the VA saying, oh, we know this now? The original application clearly asks questions about whether children exist. So one thought experiment I've sort of put through is, well, let's say that the original application had been filled out in 1969, and it said, yes, there are two children on the application. It says application by parents. It doesn't say for parents. But the question is, well, would that application in 1969, if it had listed the children, would it be an application for the children? I think there's a good argument that it would be. And then you can take that and pretty clearly take the next step forward, which is, well, if it can be an application for the children, can't it be an incomplete or a defective application for the children if that information is filled out incorrectly? I mean, I take Judge Allen's point, well, that this is a bit of a square peg in a round hole. There's no denying that this application doesn't say, hey, we're also applying for the children. But, you know, the question is, you know, I think the VA has the ability to read into this application what it needs to do, if it wants to, in order to make this a valid application. I'm not saying it has to, but I think it can.
Taking this to an extreme, because that's what we do here, would this be a veteran hasn't put down a disability on a claim form and later says, oh, but I claimed it in that claim. All I said was knee. But I now also have a back disability that I'm asserting I raised in that particular application, because now we have information that my knee and back were both service-related, and I want an effective date back to 1969 when I filed my knee application. So wouldn't that be incomplete or defective in the same context?
You know, I don't know that I would go that far to say that it's the same sort of thing. I think that our situation is more like the situation in Clemens, where a veteran might fill out an application and say, you know, I want service connection for PTSD. It doesn't say anything about depression. Turns out he has depression. Well, you know, that application never said anything about PTSD or about depression. It only mentioned PTSD. You know, the court has said that, you know, not only can, but the VA should be construing the original application.
Wouldn't that be an instance if the application was blank when asked about if there were children or a spouse? Here it actually said neither.
I suppose it could be. I mean, I think the other difference between the example that you gave and this example is that, again, In your example, you have a veteran who is sort of responsible for their own case all along and doesn't, you know, sort of sits on his or her rights at the beginning and doesn't assert a claim. In this situation, we have minor children who aren't in control of their own destiny at this point. They don't have the ability to fill out an application. They didn't even know about this application, I don't believe, until they their grandparents passed away and they found the documents in their estate. So I think that's an important difference. And again, I come back to, hey, is the board able, or do we want to say the board has no authority or ability to come back and fix something like this?
And Joe, are you basically, this is my word, not yours, but basically saying that the board can today look back at this thing that was filed in 1969 and recognize sort of what I call the weasel rule, right, which is that at the time, the people who filed this application could not have received the benefit they sought had they checked the box that said, yes, there were children, right?
Presumably. I don't know that there was actually they were actually going to be losing benefits if the children got them at the time, but that is a possibility, sure.
So if the board were to conclude that there was a weasel-like activity back there, your argument basically is it can construe that application with the desire to cure the weasel problem, in other words, at that particular time, as opposed to, because what I'm thinking about is Judge Sherwin's question about, is there a limiting principle, as opposed to somebody who just made a mistake or perhaps did something else. I mean, arguably, this rule you're suggesting could be limited to circumstances in which there's some nefarious activity going on.
I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think there should be a rule that says that the VA is not allowed to do that. I think that when the board says, hey, we really wish we could help, but you know what, our hands are tied, there's absolutely nothing we can do, we're not going to assist you, we're not going to, you know, they didn't say specifically we're not going to look at the application, but they said, you know, as a matter of law, we're required to do this. I think, you know, what they're basically saying is we don't have power to do anything. And my idea is, yeah, I think you do have power. I don't know that it's an unlimited power, but yeah, I think that, you know, there's this quote I come back to, which is carved on the outside of the VA headquarters, you know, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. I mean, that's not codified into law, but I think it's the spirit in which the VA operates. And I think that the law and the regulations that have come out, they all fall into that sort of scheme where the idea is, yeah, you know, the VA is allowed to sort of fudge information if it's going to be helpful. They're allowed, for instance, to accept a Form 9 or accept jurisdiction over a case when a substantive appeal isn't filed. The VA is allowed, like in Clemens, to read into an application that you know, even though they said one thing that they wanted benefits for, they really are going to get benefits for something else. So, yeah, the answer is, yeah, I think if that's in the mind of the people at the board and they want to fix this, take this square peg and put it through that round hole because it's the right thing to do, I think they should be allowed to do that under certain circumstances.
Can I clarify? Are you asking the court in the first instance to address whether or not this 1969 application was either incomplete or an informal claim for the appellants? Are you asking us to send it back to the board to do that in the first instance?
Well, I'm saying at a minimum that should be done by the board in the first instance. That the board, you know, my argument has been all along that when the board said there's nothing we can do, that's not true. There is something they can do. So, I mean, sure, I'd love it if the board, or if the court came back and said that, you know, this in fact is an incomplete application.
Do you have authority to address that in the first instance?
I think the answer is that, you know, whether an application constitutes a claim, I think that's a factual finding made by the board in the first instance. So I don't think the court generally would take the step of actually making that determination without the board doing so in the first instance.
Before we could do that, though, the standard that you need to meet is that it was reasonably raised before the board that these issues were.
I suppose that's important. I don't know that it's required. I mean, I don't think that the board in this case said there's nothing we can do, and we're required to deny it as a matter of law. I do think it was reasonably raised, and you know, it's that portion in the hearing. But I think the board, in its sympathetic reading, has the ability to sua sponte bring it up itself.
If I can again change tactics or change question area, in Burris, which I know you asserted didn't apply in this case based on a factual distinction, the court held that the appellant's age was a bar to benefits basically on any basis. The fact that your clients are over 18 or 23, depending on the circumstance, at this point or at the time of the 2010 application, how is that not a bar to benefits?
Well, I think the difference is that it would be a bar to benefits if the initial application is found to only be made after the children had passed the age of majority. I see my time is about to run out.
Yes, she's just going to add 2 more minutes.
Great. So I think that's a critical difference. To illustrate, let's imagine that you have a child who's 17 years old and clearly, you know, would be eligible based upon their age, and they put in an application for benefits. The VA takes, 5 or 6 years in this case to finally come to a decision, and by the time they come to a decision, the child or the veteran is now 25 years old. I don't believe that they can't receive benefits because the decision is made when they're 25. And I think the Burris case, as well as a few other cases, Suchik and Erspammer, they all stand for the idea that, you know, it really depends on whether you're eligible at the time of application. And I think in this case, the board can find them eligible based upon the 1969 application.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The secretary requests that the court affirm the two January 29, 2016 board decisions because there is no basis for granting the DIC benefits that the appellants seek as a matter of law. The parties are not in dispute that due to the provisions of the effective date regulations governing DIC, that the date upon which a claimant is assessed as a child will differ based upon when their application was submitted. If the application was submitted within 1 year after the date of death of the veteran, the date upon which we would assess if the claimant is a child would be the date of the death of the veteran. If it's submitted beyond that 1 year after the veteran dies, then we would look to the date of receipt of the claim at that point as to whether or not a claimant was a child as of that date. And so the parties aren't in dispute as to that. What we disagree on is whether there was such a claim that was filed within 1 year of the date of death that relates to the appellants.
Could I interrupt for 1 second to ask basically the same question that Judge Meredith asked right at the end of the opposing party's argument, which is, if that's right, and that's how I read your briefing as well, that you essentially agree on the trigger date, for lack of a better word, it seemed to me that a fair reading of the board's two decisions here was that it just sort of got that wrong, right? It just said you filed in 2010 and you're 40 and so it's off the table. And the board didn't really wrestle with all of these issues about what the 1969 thing could have been, because I think you'd agree that if in fact that 1969 document was an application on behalf of the children, that would come within a date on which benefits could be paid to them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the board didn't get to the issue of the 1969 application because the secretary maintains that it's not reasonably raised, that that was a claim that was filed on behalf of the appellants. And so there, it wasn't reasonably raised, as Judge Meredith pointed out. It wasn't raised in any of their pleadings. And even in the hearing transcript, the appellant's representative indicated that a claim was never filed on their behalf. So it didn't...
And can I stop for one second? Because I want you to continue to talk about that, because I agree with you. I think that that's the most important question here, that first question I asked the appellant's counsel. But let's just assume for one second that the claim was reasonably raised in the sense that the board knew about the 1969 application and enough that it should have looked at it. Okay, let's just assume that world for a second. In a situation like that, the board seemed to be either under a misapprehension that because they were 40 now, they were just categorically done and there's nothing we can do, or it didn't wrestle with the 1969 application. Again, assuming that it knew about it, right? In that situation, and this is, I think, what Judge Meredith was asking in some sense too, in that situation, wouldn't we then just have to send this back to the board, right? If the board had the wrong legal rule and it should have discussed something, but it didn't, what I'm trying to get at is, if we conclude this is reasonably raised, is the secretary asking us, as the court, to go and wrestle with all of these issues about the 1969 application as part of our obligation to assume that there, or to determine that there's no prejudicial error?
Our position would be that it would not have to go back, that the court could look at the face of the application and determine that this was not a claim for the appellants. A claim has to typically identify who the claimants are and their relationship to the veteran. And so in looking at the 1969 application, those elements are not present. So this, just on its face, is something that there would be no need to send it back for the board to address that.
But can we find that on the first instance?
I think that the court could, because you would be considering whether or not this was a claim. And of course, this would only also be if the court can determine that this issue was even reasonably raised in the first place, and the secretary maintains that it isn't.
Right, but let's say, like, are you asserting that we would look at whether this is even a claim as part of the question of whether this issue is reasonably raised analysis, or if we were to find that it was reasonably raised by their argument that there's no error because there's no claim?
The secretary's position is that there is no error because there is no claim here that was ever made on behalf of the appellants.
So then I get back to my question, which is the determination of whether a claim was filed something that we can decide in the first instance, or is that a factual determination that the board needs to make?
The court's jurisprudence speaks to whether or not something is a claim or not. And so I think that arguably it's a legal determination to just look at whether or not this document meets the definition of a claim. And so the court could address that and not have to send it back in this case.
If it were either a factual question or a mixed question of law and fact, in the sense that embedded in a legal thing are some factual nuggets, what's the secretary's position about what we should do in that situation? Say, for example, we thought it was, and I'm just making this up, that we thought it was important whether the VA had knowledge of whether the children existed at the time, right? So which might require us to go and look at other documents that the veteran might have filled out or something. If we had to wrestle with factual issues, would you say that we have the authority to do that, or that we should remand to the board?
I'm not sure I understand.
So
Judge Sherwin asked you about whether we could look at the application and make that determination initially, and your response, which I thought was a good one, is there's case law that says that whether there's an application is a question of law. Let's just assume that's true. Mm-hmm. Right? But assume, now what I'm asking you to assume is that, but embedded within that question of law, there is a factual thing we have to decide, meaning, well, there might be an intent for benefits if the VA had knowledge that the children existed. Let's just assume that. That's a factual question embedded in a legal analysis. If we thought that there were things like that, could we engage in that determination here as part of our obligation to take account of the rule of prejudicial error? Or would it be better to send it back to the board to assess those factual things embedded in the legal analysis?
Well, I think the record of proceedings is properly before this court, and so the court could look at the record as to whether or not there was any intent or whether or not the VA had any knowledge. And it's clear that, given the record in front of us already, that the VA had no such knowledge. So I don't think that we would need to send it back for those things based on what's already before the court in the record. So the Secretary maintains that the 2010 applications are the only applications that can be reasonably construed as claims that were filed on behalf of the appellants in this case. The 1969 application was a complete claim for the parents and was not and has never been a claim, incomplete, informal, or otherwise, for the appellants. The VA can't grant benefits if a claim has not been filed. And the 1969 application, as we've already gone over, was not reasonably raised as a claim for the appellants.
I can interject, please.
Certainly.
In Van Valkenburg, this court looked at some new stuff, some old stuff, things that were in the record, to sort of mush together to find a claim. Why? How is this case different?
So in Van Valkenburg, this court remanded for the agency to consider whether the appellant's application contained a mistake. When the application indicated within it that the claimant had not filed for VA benefits prior to that point. And there was already, it was clear from VA's own files that was not correct. That in fact, the claimant in that case had filed for benefits. And so it was clear on the face of the record before the VA and before the court that there was a potential mistake. And so the court remanded for the agency to consider that. We don't have the same situation here because there's no indication that there was a mistake that was made in the 1969 application.
Well, on its face in Mrs. Van Valkenburg's application, if you looked at the four corners of it, there was no indication that there was a mistake. You had to look at extra evidence in order to illuminate that mistake. And so I think your opposing counsel's argument here is on the four corners of the 1969 application, you would not find that a mistake had been made, but it's only in light of the additional information from 2010, et cetera, that illuminates the mistake.
In Van Valkenburg, the application was pending, and the evidence that conflicted with what was in the application was already in VA's file. Here, you don't have an application that was pending. The 1969 application, there was already a final decision on that. So the 2010 application, by the time it was received, there's no basis in law that would indicate that we could go back and sort of resurrect the 1969 application and use that to
I'm not sure if my understanding of Van Valkenburg is the exact same as yours. What was pending was her, we'll call it second application, right? They never found the first application. What they had was a request for burial benefits, which I think the law specifically says is not also a request for DIC. So there was nothing, and then there was something, as opposed to here where there's maybe a mistaken something and then now a pending application. But I could be incorrect if your understanding of the facts is different.
My understanding is that there was an application that she had previously made a request for burial benefits, and on her new application, she indicated she'd never applied for VA benefits. So clearly, she had done so when she applied for burial benefits. And in that case, the CAVC remanded for the agency to consider whether or not, therefore, that application contained a mistake. I think the difference that you have here is that, again, the 1969 application is no longer pending by the time we get the 2010 application.
Well, but that's the thing. On one way of looking at it, that's absolutely right. But it gets sort of slippery, right? Because if you then say that application actually should be construed as something different than what it might have looked like on its face, then part of that application has been denied and the other part of it nobody ever ruled on. Right. So, I mean, it's almost like a metaphysical question because it sort of gets us back in the circle, right? Because if we can construe that application to be for the children, then nobody ever adjudicated it, so it sort of remains pending. So it's sort of hard to say I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure that that gets us very far in trying to wrestle with that question, if we even have to wrestle with that question.
Our position is that the 1969 application on its face does not mention the appellants. And so a claim, by definition, has to name the claimants and their relationship to the veteran. And because it does not do that, I don't think that we even – and there was a final adjudication on the claim that was filed, which was for the parents. I don't think we get to – the 2010 application being able to amend back the 1969 application. The application at question 21 actually specifically asks whether or not the veteran is survived by a spouse or any children, and the response clearly indicates neither. So not only are the appellants not named, their existence and their relationship to the veteran is explicitly denied. There was a follow-up question, actually, also in the application that asked for the name and address of any surviving children, and neither of the appellant's names are listed. Also, the veteran's parents did not disclose the existence of the appellants when they collected life insurance benefits based on the veteran's death, even though they were informed that his surviving children could be potential beneficiaries. So there were multiple opportunities to disclose the existence of the appellants, but none of them were utilized. And so in addition to their names not being there and their relationship to the veteran not being there, the Secretary's position is there's also no intent to have filed a claim for the appellants either. And so pursuant to 38 CFR 3.160 and CFR 3.155, we believe that those are instructive, which indicate that a claim has to identify the benefit sought, the claimant, and the relationship to the veteran. And so applying that here, this was clearly a claim for the parents. It was never a claim, never intended to be a claim for the appellants.
What do minors, what can they do as a remedy in a circumstance where somebody is not advocating for their rights?
In this circumstance, I'm not sure what all of their realm of remedies might be outside of VA benefits. Perhaps there would be a civil remedy against the grandparents' estate for not having filed for them.
Well, let's say in the VA context, is there anything they can do that they could have done when they were minors or once they reached majority?
The VA I mean, our duty is to notify the next of kin, which on the emergency contact forms was listed as the parents, and let them know that they're, who the potential, that potential beneficiaries may be entitled to DIZ, that would include parents, surviving spouse, and children, and we did that. To the extent that the person who was notified properly by VA did not advocate for those children, I'm not sure, I'm not aware of a remedy that VA is able to give to those children. I think that, again, the remedy would be against the estate of the veteran's parents, perhaps. But in this case, I'm not sure what more VA could do other than notify the people that we're aware of, and when we did that properly, and assume that when they signed that claim form that says that it, all the information is provided to the best of their knowledge and with truth and veracity, that they're telling the truth. And so without further information, you know, again, we're sympathetic, but there's no remedy that we could have provided at this point.
Can I jump in there? At the 2015 hearing, the appellants testified that their mother may have gone to the Social Security Administration and sought benefits at the time of the veteran's death. Do you know if VA has ever asked Social Security whether a claim was filed at that time on behalf of the children? And do VA have any obligation to try to track down those records?
No, VA, our position is VA did not have any duty to ask for that. In 38 U.S.C. 5105, the Social Security application, as well as an application before the VA for survivor's benefits, essentially there's reciprocity when one is filed. But the statute also indicates that if we receive that application, we would provide a copy to the Social Security Administration and that they would do the same. There was nothing that was ever provided to us, and so the presumption of regularity is that had one been submitted, that we would have received it. I also noted in that hearing transcript that it says that the mother went to the Social Security office and was told that she was not eligible. It doesn't indicate that an application was actually filed. To the point of the 1969 application, I know the court raised in its briefing order whether or not it could be viewed as an incomplete claim. The Secretary's position is that the 1969 application was not one that was incomplete, and it doesn't, regardless of what definition of that term is used. Whether or not we use a common dictionary definition, there's also Federal Circuit case law that indicates that an application is incomplete if it's missing critical information necessary to process the claim. The M21 manual that the appellants noted in their brief indicates that an application is incomplete if development is not feasible as a result of the lacking information. Whichever of those definitions that we would employ, this is not an incomplete application on its face. There was no absence of information that was necessary to proceed with developing or processing the claim. Question 21 was clearly answered, and the question wasn't left blank or unfinished. No information was missing such that VA would have been unable to process the claim or complete development. And clearly they did so because they rendered a final decision as to the parents' claims. And so whatever definition of incomplete you use, this on its face just simply was not an incomplete application. It was a completed application for the parents. It was not an application for the appellants in this case. Finally, the Secretary notes that even if the 1969 application were to be deemed incomplete in some way, the appellants haven't identified or pursued any kind of legal remedy or avenue of relief that would afford them the benefits sought. We're not aware of any petition for equitable relief that was filed, and there are only two instances in which the finality of a previous decision can be vitiated, and that would be clear and unmistakable error and new material evidence, and neither of those theories have been advanced here. And so to set aside the 1969 decision that was rendered in this case, there's no basis or avenue of relief that's been advanced that we could employ here. The Secretary also notes that concerning incomplete applications, the only remedy that would be available is not one that would result in the appellants receiving the benefits that they sought. If an application is received and is incomplete, the VA is required to provide notice to the appellant to the claimant of the additional information that's needed. And in this situation, in any situation, if that's not done, pursuant to 38 CFR 3.109B, even if that notice isn't provided, it doesn't toll the filing deadline for any of the actions that need to be done. So even if there was some kind of notice that VA should have provided to the appellants in this case in 1969, and again, I'm not sure how VA would have ever known of their existence, but even assuming that the court were to go there, the only thing that VA would have had to do would be to provide the notice, and even if it wasn't done, that doesn't save them from having had file a claim. So there's no claim that was ever filed here.
I'm sorry. I could follow up with that. Let's say a claim was filed, the information was incomplete, because that's ordinarily how VA would then send, mm-hmm. like, a claim form or request for more information, right? So then a claim was filed, but no decision was made. So it's not like they had an obligation to file an NOD or anything like that. So they would have had the obligation to provide the information, but VA wouldn't have had to send the notice if there wasn't a claim.
Right.
So if there was a claim and VA had an obligation to send a notice, then it wouldn't be final.
I'm sorry.
Okay. No, because I was just wondering, you were saying that it wouldn't toll anything, but there's nothing to toll. It's pending, right?
If there had been a claim, if this was regarded as a claim for the appellants, and we would have, and it would have been regarded as an incomplete claim,
right.
We would have had to provide notice of the information that was missing. But even if that notice was not provided pursuant to 38 CFR 3.109B, that doesn't change the time limits for filing a claim. So even if VA...
But they'd file the claim. Otherwise, why would you send the notice?
Right. Well, the incomplete... the claim that was filed was for the parents. So the allegation here is that it was incomplete as to the claim, who the claimants were. And so,
I think we're sort of not saying, if it was incomplete as to the children, then the only reason you would have an obligation to send a notice to the children is if there was a claim for them. Otherwise, you would have no obligation to send a notice regarding them, right?
And our position is that there was no claim.
Right. But you also didn't send notice. So
right.
Let me see if I can get this. Let's just assume that I can just find a claim for myself, mm-hmm. right? And I have to fill in three blocks, block one, block two, block three, okay? And I leave block three empty. So I have tried to make a claim, but it's an incomplete claim. Mm-hmm. And basically what you're saying is, in a situation like that, VA has an obligation to tell me, hey, you forgot to fill in block three. Mm-hmm. That will finish your claim. You didn't tell me, mm-hmm. and so I didn't do anything. But effectively, the position is, but because that was incomplete at the beginning, you tried to make a claim, but that wasn't good enough because you didn't complete it. Right? Is that basically what you're saying? Is that the clock for these appellants under this theory didn't stop merely because the application was incomplete?
Yes.
And then it ran out. And now, even though the VA had an obligation to provide them notice, because you didn't provide them notice, hypothetically,
too bad.
They never fixed the claim, so they aged out at 18.
Correct.
Is that roughly what I'm understanding?
Correct.
All right.
Thank you.
So it doesn't remain pending like a Tablazon-type violation?
No. I mean, with informal claims, there's notice that would have to be provided, but the regulations are that if there's no response that's received within a year, then...
Of the notice.
But under 38 CFR 3.109, the time is not told if that notice isn't provided. So there's no remedy that that would avail them of the benefits that they're seeking.
If the VA doesn't do what they do, too bad for the veteran.
I'm sorry?
If the VA doesn't do what they're supposed to do, too bad for the veteran.
I mean, I can only look at what the regulation states.
I appreciate that, and you didn't write the regulation.
Just very quickly, I see that I only have 2 minutes left. I know that the court raised the issue of paternity, the Secretary's position is that we don't even need to get to those questions if the court finds in this case that there is not a application or a claim that was ever pending to the as to the appellants. And so we don't need to reach those issues today. If the court has any questions regarding that, I would be happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I will quickly sum up. Okay. The Secretary maintains that the first and only question that the court really has to answer today is whether or not there was a claim that was ever filed on behalf of the appellants that was filed within 1 year of the date of the veteran's death. And in this case, the 1969 application simply can't be reasonably construed as anything other than a completed application for the parents. And it outright denies that the veteran has any surviving children, and that's really what this case turns on today. A final decision was issued on that claim. There's no basis in law to vitiate the finality of that decision, and there's no legal remedy or relief available that would afford them the benefit that they seek. And for these reasons, the Secretary respectfully requests that the Board's January 29, 2016 decisions be affirmed. Thank you.
Your Honors, there are a few things that I'd like to go back to. The first one is whether the issue of the 1969 application was reasonably raised below. And another thing I'd like to point the Court's attention to is the Form 9 filed by the appellants where they say, quote, due to the nature at the time of death, essentially that their parents had committed the grandparents had committed fraud. It's not the model of, like, hey, I'm pointing you to the 1969 application, but I think it's another instance where the question about what was filed in 1969 is brought up by the appellants. Second thing I'd like to bring up is the question about whether the court in right now can address the question about whether the 1969 claim counts for the children. And I point the court's attention back to Westbury case, which says that the determination about whether an informal claim has been filed usually requires an application of the law to the facts of a particular case. And in this case, again, I would say that at a minimum, the facts of the case do need to be addressed by the board about not to mention the question about the duty to assist. The duty to assist may play into finding information that would have shown that the VA did have actual notice of the children. We don't have any of the service medical records. We don't have all of the applications filed. No one has gone to Social Security specifically. As far as the Social Security regulations, just looking at them, I believe they say that VA may request the application. I don't know that the VA's regulations specifically say that Social Security will provide an application. So that's another avenue for the VA to review. I think finally I'd like to point out that the fact that the application, whether it actually is incomplete, whether the 1969 application is complete, really goes to the question, as I think Your Honors have pointed out, about what you construe the application to be. If you construe it to be an application for the children, and after all, grandparents are the type of people who would have filed an application for the children. The VA wrote to them at the time and said, we're providing you with information to apply for, you know, yourselves as well as for children or spouses. If you construe that application in the first instance to be an application for the children, then it is an incomplete application on its face. And finally, I'd like to point out also that I think the question under 3.109 about an application, what happens if you have an incomplete application where the VA never provides notice? I think the Secretary is asserting that, or suggesting that, if the VA never says, hey, your application is incomplete, then you never have a chance to complete it. I think in this case what you have is you have a situation where, regardless of the fact about whether the VA actually asked for more information, the children provided it. And at that point, I think the application became complete. So it's another situation. Once that information was submitted, I think you can read the 1969 application as being pending for that period. And I don't know that there's anything in 3.109 that says there's a time limit for completing an incomplete application, especially if the VA doesn't ask you for it. If they do, I see that as a limit, that if the VA says, hey, by the way, your application doesn't provide information we need, there's something incorrect on it, can you fix it, can you sign it, can you provide us with an address, whatever it is, and no one responds within a year, well, that cuts it off. But I don't think the failure of the VA to do anything, to ask for that information, means that there is no opportunity to actually provide the missing information. And I think that's what happened here. If there's nothing else, I will finish up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted for decision. The court is now adjourned. We will come down and greet counsel.